Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and today, magical cinema. We have with us again a repeat customer, Ansaro Ali, author, ritualist, astrologer, and filmmaker. And we're going to be talking about Ansaro's latest film, The Dream of Falling Upward. It's just come out. And for those of you in the Bay Area, you'll have a chance to see it on the Equinox, March 21st in Berkeley. We'll give you more information about that just coming up. But it's a fabulous film, and it has the distinction of being, I am absolutely sure, the most accurate representation of certain currents of magical subculture and experience. Certainly that I've ever seen on cinema. But luckily, it's not even just about magic. It's about a lot of things. And so we'll be getting to that. It was a wonderful reminder for me, A, how satisfying non-commercial cinema can be. It's very well shot, wonderfully acted, very vibrant, intelligent, and engaging in the way that you want a movie to be, entertaining as well as magically stimulating. And indeed, the whole question of the relationship of magic to cinema is a profound one. This mysterious, lucid camera of moving images created from the series of single images or with video, the traces of electronic light manifesting as continuous images, the dreams that we can share and make together, and indeed, including the dream falling upwards. Before we bring Ansaro on, of course, we have our co-host here this week, Maja Daou, crawling her way back from some infernal sickness. So we're happy to have you. How are you doing there, Maja?
I'm doing a lot better, Eric. Thanks. I've been tormented by demons for the past 6 weeks. So yes, I'm getting better.
That's great. Well, you know, it's always tough with talking about movies and books. You don't want to give stuff away, but there's a remarkable demon in this film that's not like any other demon. You know, like when you think about being possessed by a demon, that you get sort of, you know, exorcist images in your mind. But the demon possession in this film is much more disturbing, but also kind of funny. It's really kind of remarkable. It's hard to describe exactly, but it's not what you think it is. And yet, by the mere fact that it never goes away, it becomes quite disturbing for one of the characters. So in a way, it is kind of like a sickness. You know, it's like, oh, it's just, but it just doesn't go away, and it takes on a
right. You know, well, it's true, and like there's some
quality.
Yeah, like, you know, I had pneumonia, and pneumonia is a special kind of demon because it lives in your body all the time, and then takes over when you're weak. So you can't, there's some demons that you can't exercise because they're endogenous, you know. It's just more about talking to them and keeping them in check and kind of preventing them from destroying everything. But then they just kind of like hang out on your couch all the time. And when you're not looking, they can cause trouble, you know.
Well, that's exactly what, in fact, I think the demon that possesses one of the characters in the film literally hangs out on the couch. it's a really apt synchronicity. So let's bring on Ansaro to the show. Ansaro, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Hey, thanks. Great to be here.
Yeah, it's so fun to have you back again. I mean, yeah, once again, congratulations on the film. And I thought I would read the synopsis from the website because it's safer than me trying to summarize it or asking you to do it probably, you know, the hundredth time. Just to set it out without blowing the plot points, because there are really some nice twists and turns in the story. The elder Magus of the Thelemic Temple of Horus, which is an invention but is very accurately drawn, has passed away. Jack Mason, a promising young sex magician cultivated to advance the lineage, loses his chance at occult advancement when the elder Magus's biological son unexpectedly inherits the order. Jack plots deadly revenge and falls into a dizzying maze of underworld encounters with professional psychopaths, desert brujas, and a twist of fate he never saw coming. Or did he? Meanwhile, Jack assigns his two hot-headed apprentices an ego-corrosive ritual of going into business as clowns to perform the classic fairy tale Jack and the Beanstalk for children, which is, like, even if the film didn't have the clown thing in it, it would just be great, but the clown line just puts it over the top. But I will talk about that later. First, let's start out with the sort of magical material and maybe a little bit about your own personal background in the kind of thalamic, magical milieu and you know, how and why you decided to bring it and really kind of concentrate that as a setting for this film.
Oh, okay. Let's see. From about 1985 to 1990, for about 5 years there, I had the good fortune to develop a friendship, a kind of a mentorship, really, with this Magus of several orders. His name, his pseudonym was Christopher S. Hyatt, and his actual name was Alan Miller, and he passed away about 4 years ago. And even though I didn't personally join any orders, I have my own work cut out for me in the area of ritual, something I call paratheater, something I've been doing for about 30-plus years that keeps me kind of in the current of you know, accessing sources of energy in the body and these kinds of asocial group ritual dynamics that I've been working actively with ever since. But hanging out with Hyatt over those years, and like I said, he was kind of a mentor to me at that time, really opened my eyes to a whole different way of thinking and a whole different, you know, world to step in and participate in. And he offered all kinds of options of membership and joining this or that because, you know, we had, he was also the publisher of a few of my books. He was a publisher of what was called the Falcon Press at that time and is now called the Original Falcon Press, continues. And let's see, when Hyatt passed away, he died of cancer and some complications with multiple strokes. And he was on his deathbed, spiked with a lot of morphine. He had just endured about 8 or 9 strokes, and he was just barely conscious. And that is actually when his biological son showed up with a couple of attorney-witnesses and forced the old guy's hand in the signing over of his company to the biological son, a huge company, Falcon Press, was actually meant to pass over to Hyatt's business partner of 35 years, Nick Tarcher. But the biological son got it, and this aroused all kinds of all kinds of trouble in the court systems. They're now still in court after about 4 years. They're still battling it out to see, you know, what's really going on there. But my personal reaction to that, I was, and by the way, this whole episode of forcing the hand and so forth, it's all documented online. If people want to go and discover the sordid details, they can go to verticalpool.com-fallingup.html and look for the link called, I think it's called Director's Notes or Liner's Notes or, you know, something like that, and you'll find it. Anyway, my personal response to his passing, I was saddened and outraged because I was also part of that press and my books were involved, but I also had, you know, a personal, you know, relationship with Hyatt. And I just, you know, felt helpless, not being able to do anything about what happened. And after a couple of years of just kind of moping about it, I realized, well, you know, I can make a movie. And so the movie idea spun off from my responses to a real-life event. And then my imagination took hold, as it will do with, you know, every one of my movies is based on real-life events, some kernel of truth, some event that actually happened. Then my imagination gets a hold of it, and it spins it into a different direction. And so that's basically the short story of my answer.
Well, one thing to point out to listeners is just how significant Falcon Press was for kind of, you know, both sustaining and channeling and in some ways creating a certain specific current of magical thought and philosophy and humor in the way in which it sort of took an element of the Aleister Crowley's Thalamic inspiration, you know, modified, mutated by the great Robert Anton Wilson, and very much carried forward and changed again in multiple interesting ways by your own work. I mean, I really see what you did with, you know, the classic angel tech and with your later texts, including your recent book on the Eighth Circuit Model, which of course is drawing from Leary and Robert Anton Wilson, as well as really carrying forward a certain strain, to my mind, the most interesting and productive strain in a lot of ways of modern magic. And so it's really interesting the way that, so in the film, it's rather than being about a publisher, it actually ends up being about a certain, you know, created, invented, but still very realistic current of a Thalamic order. So it's a really appropriate way of re-embedding that real life story into a kind of a fictional universe.
Well, yeah, it's true. And back in the 80s, Falcon Press was indeed a kind of a seminal influence in the subculture or the occulture movement. Most of the books by Robert Anton Wilson and Timothy Leary and Crowley, myself, but many other people were published through there. And so they really started their own kind of small revolution and, you know, turning people on to, the books and the ideas of these authors. What's interesting that I have found, I've toured this film up and down the West Coast where various OTO bodies in Seattle and in Portland and the Bay Area hosted screenings. And at first I was feeling a little intimidated, wondering if they were going to, you know, tar and feather me because I presented this story of a kind of an OTO type of organization where a certain drama unfolds within the context of that order. And yet what I discovered that the OTO bodies in all three cities that hosted the screenings, thank God these people had a sense of humor so that they got the humor. In fact, they got all of the humor, which I was really satisfied with. And they were able to see that I was not making a film ridiculing the order, but rather exposing some of the perils and pitfalls of any kind of flawed human being participating in high levels of magic, some of the consequences that can and do occur, and then where does that go, and how can a person transform a potentially catastrophic psychic event into something maybe even transcendent?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that I thoroughly enjoyed about it, was that it gave a very human picture of this, you know, rather arcane and still pretty underground practice, where certainly in terms of film, mainstream film, even experimental films that I've seen that have some kind of magical or Thalamic current in it, it's either, you know, highly fantasized or it tries to sort of just, you know, communicate the magical reality. Whereas what you were doing was you're showing, like, whatever magic is, it's also, you know, a thing groups of people do together. They have, you know, interpersonal problems. There are politics. There's legal issues. There's, you know, erotic dimensions. You know, all that you find in all human groups is going on, of course, even in these esoteric orders. So without, like, you know, bringing down the magical potential, we also see the way in which it just fits into these particular people's lives. And the main magician, you know, Jack was incredibly well drawn because he clearly has a certain nobility to him, a certain kind of someone who has worked with his will, who has broken through a lot of the kind of ordinary neurosis that a lot of people have, and yet at the same time, he's still very flawed. We see that he's in a very urban context and has some of the markers of a kind of, you know, of an urban character, some flaws that are really recognizable. And so that's really wonderful. And then there's this whole other dimension, which we haven't talked about and makes the film all the richer, is that you really have two magical universes or currents being represented. On the one hand, we have this urban Thelemic order and the kinds of, you know, characters that are involved there, and then we have this rural shamanic earth magic, more feminine tantric chunk, you know, that kind of zone, and they interact in this really wonderful way that has to do with plot turns we don't want to reveal, but What made you? I mean, like, it would have been enough just to do something about a Thelemite order and, you know, capture the politics and capture the human drama. What was it that also called to you to bring in this other magical current and maybe talk a little bit about how you see them operating differently?
Oh yeah, great question. Every film project, part of what's fun about it for me is the research. And with this one, I became intrigued by the mysterious disappearance of Carlos Castaneda's three witches. These were three gals who accompanied Castaneda on a number of workshops when he was alive. And they also worked independently to lead workshops in Mexico and so forth, at what's called tensegrity, these kinds of physical ritual yoga type of processes. And then the day after Castaneda passed away, they disappeared. No more workshops, no more lectures, nothing else was heard from them. And I became very intrigued by this idea. Okay, well, what happened to these women? Where did they go? What are they doing? And so I guess clearly imagined that at least one of them went out into some desert region and established her own presence and life and her magical practices out there. And so that became the character of the desert bruja. And then she discovers an additional bruja out there that was there before her as an older woman. And so there's that relationship going on out there. I also became fascinated by these two different approaches to magic, you know, with the urban sex magic and the OTO thelemic hermetic orientation. Is more of a development of the will towards the creation of realities, meaning magic as having an intentional effect on the world according to one's own will, one's own intention, and manifesting according to one's will. In the rural magic, as I was starting to discover more of that, and I've discovered, you know, some of this in my own paratheta work, it's not so much about the asserting of the will to affect change, but it's more about alignment with the existing conditions or forces that be. And so I was looking at these two orientations between alignment with forces and then controlling those forces according to one's intention. And that became really a fascinating dialogue, in a sense, between two different ways of knowing magic that, to me, in my mind at least, both of them are contained in a much larger category, meaning those are two subcategories of a larger category of magic that I don't even have a name for yet, but I think is practiced by people who can participate, you know, in both realms, you know, that can drop the will and align with nature, and then can pick up the will and affect a change according to their will.
Yeah, there's really good There's really good descriptions of that in the Taoist material. I remember reading, there was this really funny old Chinese Taoist guy who said, the Westerners are so silly. They try to take their will and make a dam to control the river. And he said, the Taoist just watches the way the river flows and uses it, you know, as it goes, not trying to kind of make it go in a direction that is counter to its nature, but instead using the flow of it the way, you know, that it's already going. So it's like less effort, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But like you said, both of those things come into interplay. Like everyone has to eventually utilize their will in some form. So I think it's, you know, like you said, I think it's a combination of trying to figure out, like, well, which way are the energies going today? Like with astrology, you know, is it strong Saturn day? Like that'll make my job a lot easier if I do a Saturn spell on that day. So it's really just about looking at what direction they're going and then using that like a surfboard or something, you know?
That's a really good way of putting it. It reminds me of, you know, the old story of the shaper and the shaped. You know, in any given moment, is it more appropriate to shape the reality at hand or let it shape us?
Right.
You know, and for me, I tend to lean over towards more of the rural side. You know, to me, I'm a great fan of letting the situation be the boss and, you know, taking my cues from the existing conditions of things. And then if I have, you know, some will left over to do something, that's you know, icing on the cake.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting also to think about those two things, and I think that's really, it's even clear in the movie and in the way you talk about it, of contrasting urban and rural as a way of thinking about that. Because this contrast goes all the way back to medieval magic, when you're like, where's magic in the Middle Ages? Well, on one hand, even though we don't know exactly what they were doing, you have all these village witches and warlocks using herbs and incantations and remnants of some kind of pagan lore mixed with weird Christian ideas, and you know, trying to make magic that works in a village setting, which has to do with people's health, which has to do with fertility, which has to do with, you know, social relations inside these small communities. It's going to be very aware of the environment, the situation, the changing in weather, the changing in animals, et cetera, et cetera. And at the same time, you know, in the monasteries, in the back rooms hidden away, you have, you know, weirdo monks who are doing angel magic and, you know, messing with demons or whatever. But they're in a very, very different social location, and that whole world produces, that's modernity, that's science, that's law, you know. And so that hermetic magic that leads ultimately to Crowley and on, that's at the heart of the way that the West works. It's in the shadows, but it's right in the middle of like this urban civilization, this global civilization that we're in. And whether or not you want to support the values of that, it's hard for most people to be fully in the rural zone. And so in some ways we're caught between a larger, no longer human world of environmental forces that call for alignment, and at the same time we, you know, are functioning in a very human, very urban, very technological world where some of that more hermetic, will-oriented magic is, you know, much more appropriate. For, like even in your film, the way those lawyers function in that initial scene where they're forcing the hand of the old Magus as he's on his deathbed, they're like these creepy angels because they're just sitting there witnessing. They're like the angels in Wings of Desire, except they're creepy.
Yeah.
But they're lawyers. It's like the creepiest creatures in the whole film, other than the demon who possesses the guy, are these lawyers. You know, that's it right there.
Yeah. It's interesting, between the polarity of the rural and the urban, I was really looking for a third point, and that's where the clowns came in. One really interesting thing that I learned in the OTO-sponsored screenings in the Q&A afterwards, where I was discussing some of sort of like what I'm doing now, a point was raised about a Western hermetic ritual called the Holy Guardian Angel. And it turns out that the work I've been doing in paratheater, specifically around the theme of what we call dialogue with the muses, Has a lot of parallel with the hermetic ritual of the Holy Guardian Angel. And when before I scripted this film, I was working in an 8-week intensive with my group with the theme of Muses dialogue, and we discovered that we had to find a charged trinity, a kind of a holy trinity, if you will, to develop some sense of personal reference that we could then interact with and even offer to the Muses archetype, which is much more powerful than our egos. And if we just went in with our egos, we'd just be fried. And that happened. We all got fried. And so we learned, okay, we got to build some kind of a base to move from towards the Muses. And the trinity that I discovered over many experimentations, you know, I just didn't think it up or, you know, it wasn't the first time it worked. But I finally came up with the trinity of Magus, Shaman, and Clown. And that somehow cohesed into kind of a core structure that begged for a story, and the story wrote itself almost by itself. But it really required clowns, and I didn't know how to put clowns into the story between urban and rural magic. And then I realized, oh, yeah, because I personally have done clowning before, and I know what an ego-corrosive process. I mean, you're out there making a fool of yourself if you're doing it right. And so it turned out that the in this story, the Magus had these two hot-headed apprentices that were just really full of themselves and, you know, trying to be the biggest Magus on the block. And the Magus was smart enough to realize, okay, what these two kids need is an ego-corrosive ritual. We'll put them into business as clowns. They got to get along well enough to you know, be in business together. And then we got to put them in front of children, the most honest people on the planet, to entertain them. And so there I found a really illuminating and hilarious relief from the urban and the rural magical paths, which, you know, have their own kind of downfalls. Each one of them are very prone to taking themselves too seriously. You know, they get trapped into a certain, whether it's morbidity or excessive self-importance or some kind of ego inflation. It's almost inevitable. And so the clowns were there as a kind of relief, a kind of a comic relief, but also a kind of oblique Greek chorus that made this commentary on the story that was unfolding, because their story was Jack and the Beanstalk.
Well, and it's magical, too. Like, a lot of people don't understand clown magic, but the clown goes back to shamanism, right? The jester, all the court gestures, those that originally comes from the shaman and the fool. And it's through imitative magic, right? Like, the shaman uses imitation, so they'll pretend to be something in order to make the magic go. Actually, when you clown someone's ego, you're providing the parody, but you're also putting it in front of their face. So it's doing the same kind of thing that, like, tarot or a divination does. When you kind of make fun of somebody, it brings that into their consciousness, and they can, like, heal that part of their ego. So not just making people do that for no reason, it actually has this deeply shamanic healing effect by doing the clowning, right? When you clown someone, what do? You parody them or imitate them.
That's,
you know?
Right, and your clown chakra opens right up.
The clown, I love the clown chakra.
Oh, that's so good.
You can never anticipate where it's actually located. That's part of its clownishness.
Exactly.
And you were, and also just to say that the two clown performers were spectacular. I mean, you really drew some great acting in this film in particular, and their physical performance especially really communicated as much as just the idea of the clown. I mean, if you had like a clown who was like an okay clown, like, you'd get the thematic concept that you were playing with, but what you really get is like clownishness and its sort of chaotic, giddy excess, really quite strongly just watching the film and watching their performance. You know, even the way that you never see the kids. You know,
yeah, they were kick-ass
clowns. Never see the kids.
Yeah, they performed. I told them that as characters, they had to perform as if their graduation in the magical order depended on it. And these hot-headed characters, they were so status-oriented, they just so desperately wanted to advance in the lineage that they just performed their asses off.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much more. I have another question about the clowns, but I think we're going to take a break now because we're at the half hour. So you're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with Antero Ali about his new movie, The Dream of Falling Upwards.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou, here with Eric Davis, and we're speaking with Antero Ali today about the OTO and demons and angels and clowns, you know, all that good stuff. Antero, I'm interested to kind of break away in another direction a little bit here about the inspiration for it and just all the business with Hyatt and forcing the hand and the kind of parasitic demons overtaking things. And I love that you put it in the structure of something like the OTO or an esoteric society, because this is something that I feel is very prevalent and certainly escalating in our culture today, where there will be these structures and establishments or religions even, or groups, or, you know, you name it, corporations. And there were these people who worked really hard to build them and to make them out of their blood and sweat and tears. And then there'll be these, you know, other folks that just sweep in and kind of take them over, you know? And I mean, you can see that happening on almost every level. Like, if you're going to look at the government, like, okay, George Washington was a general and an army guy, and he sets up the government. And the reason the president's in charge of the army, because he was a general, you know? But then you'll see all these people come in, they take it over. They're like these retarded sons, you know, that come in and just sweep in and take something and have no idea what they're doing or what the thing is about, and they just kind of take it. And in esoteric orders, you know, even the OTO is an example of that, not to, like, point fingers, but it, you know, it happens in theosophy as well, Catholic Church, look there, where they'll be, you know, this kind of person that will come in and try to take over after the leader or whatever has fallen. So you can look at it with Crowley, how, like, what happens to the organization and how do the individuals react within that, and then how do they use the magic that was made by the leader, you know, and try and do it better or as well as he did. So I was just wondering, like, you know, if kind of in your writing it and trying to purvey this message, like, not just to draw attention to kind of what happened, but were there, like, what else were you kind of message do you hope is communicated most by the movie there in those respects?
Intrigued by the nature of hierarchy. And hierarchy can exist in any organization, whether it's OTO or the government or a corporation. And the more hierarchy is emphasized, meaning whether it's very specific niches and specific, like a ladder of status where people are trying to climb to the top, the more hierarchy is emphasized, it seems to me the more fragile the group dynamic. And the stronger the group dynamics tend to be more egalitarian, where there may be a little hierarchy, but there's a lot more flexibility, and, you know, where, you know, people have a more equal say in what happens. And so that became really interesting to me, just to, you know, examine the consequences of what happens when hierarchy becomes very rigid and kind of brittle and you know, easily taken over, because it becomes more vulnerable that way. You know, like dictatorships, for example, are a really good example. And unless the dictator is very smart, you know, in terms of, okay, let's you know, has, he or she has figured out a way to keep the masses happy or content or at least secure, you know, the masses will revolt, as we see today. There's all kinds of demonstrations in the world today where, you know, people, you know, hundreds of thousands and millions of people are hitting the streets in dictator-run countries demanding, you know, the resignation of their dictator. So, you know, that came into play. And more importantly for me was kind of honing it into a more human and personal, the detail of human frailty, the decisions that certain people make, the consequences of decisions based on greed, for example, or envy. I wanted to follow that all the way through, because I think this is part of what contributes to the downfall of any hierarchy is decisions made out of greed. Greed is a real killer, and I wanted to, you know, just go into, like, well, how does greed kill? And, again, try to keep it on a human level. So I'm not trying to make a message movie or some kind of infomercial about hierarchy and corporations or whatever, but really hone it down to the particular characters involved and their decisions and the consequences of those choices, and really, you know, coming over and over again to remembering and realizing this strange little thing that I discovered, that personality may be simply a modern word for fate. And, you know, who we are becoming is really tied into the plot of our lives and where we're going to end up.
So, yeah, talk a little bit more about that fate and personality. Like, it's sort of like the temperament is kind of the destiny.
Fate, I look as different than destiny. There are two words often confused to mean the same thing. I like to use a poker, like card game poker metaphor. I see fate as pretty much, you know, whatever's in the cards, whatever hand you're dealt, that's fate. Destiny would be how you play your cards.
So destiny is the free will aspect.
Yeah, more or less, yeah. And then, you know, fate is, you know, our lot in life, you know, what we're born into. And what we have to wake up to and learn to interact with and develop some kind of identity or presence in the midst of, you know, what we cannot change or control.
Well, and it's interesting, too, just to bring astrology into it, because when you think about personality and its tie there, I mean, a lot of the, of course, psychological personality-driven stuff in astrology, you can see in your birth chart from that time that you're born. Obviously, some people would disagree, but you can really kind of use that as a marker. What kind of relationship do you find there? Is that kind of what led you to that realization? Was your work in astrology, or did it come from somewhere else?
That comes from more direct experience. Even though I'm an astrologer by trade, I still don't, you know, after 30 years of practice, I don't believe in astrology. I use it because it works.
Right.
And so I don't even use astrology in context with my films. Like, I don't, you know, create a chart for my character and say, oh, this person's a Sagittarius with a Cancer rising, so that in that way he'll act this way and so forth. I approach my films pretty instinctively. I don't even storyboard. I'm one of these people that shows up on the set and cases the joint out and looks at the angles, the lighting, and oftentimes I don't even rehearse my actors. I just, you know, choose people that can hold their own, and, you know, then we just hit the ground running.
Yeah, that comes through. In a way, that's a little bit of the clownish energy as well. You know, partly that. That spontaneity. I want to ask you one other, just like a question about the Holy Guardian Angel. And as your film makes clear, this is sort of, you know, the central rite and central experience, in a sense, of the Thelemic Order you represent and other Thelemic Orders. It's like the, you know, the passage into sort of, I mean, there's many passages, but it's one that people often talk about, and as your film makes reference to, is something that's both talked about and not talked about. It's this interesting place where it's not even a matter of that the ritual itself is secret, but the actual way you even think about or conceive what it means to have knowledge and conversation with the Holy Guardian Angel is itself deeply encrypted. And that's one of the things, like the clown characters, they want to know, like, hey, what's happening? What does it mean? And what can I do? Do you have, does it work this way? Does it work that way? I'm curious if that came up at all when you were showing the film to Thelemic Orders, whether there was some discussion about the HGA and some of the stuff that you included in the film, and just why you were sort of interested in that. In that dimension of the practice,
That came up quite a bit because it is the HGA is a central ritual in Thelema. Part of what I was talking about before about the hierarchy element of what I was studying in the OTO, there are particular grades. And the name of the specific grade where the focus of the HGA comes into play is called the Adeptus Minor. And the two clowns, the two guys, the two apprentices, they're not at the same level. One is at the Adeptus Minor, and we assume that he has achieved conversation with the HGA. The other guy is right below. It's called the Philosophus Grade. And he's complaining that he's bored with the philosopher's grade, and he'll do anything he can to get up to Adeptus Minor. And so he's always badgering the other apprentice, you know, with, well, what god form, you know, am I supposed to call, or, you know, what do I do, and, you know, is there anything that you can tell me so I can reach the HGA? So the guy that has not reached dialogue with the HGA is really obsessed with doing it. That's like his whole reason for living almost. And then the guy that's achieved the HGA, he's very nonchalant about it. He's basically, you know, his attitude is it's no big deal. It's really just part of the process of moving ahead, and you'll get to it when you're ready, that sort of thing. And the OTO people got that really clearly. Anybody who's moving through the grades in the OTO is very aware of, you know, the particular challenges of each grade, the particular research, the rituals innate to each particular grade. And so there was kind of an intrigue. They were wondering, are you an OTO member? How do you know this? And so forth. And I said, no, I just, you know, I've hung out with OTO people, and, you know, Hyatt was a mentor of mine. And so I picked up a lot along the way, but I've never been compelled to join the order, only because I've got my plate full with my own ritual practice.
Yeah. So it came through very interestingly as well. It's like almost like, What one's attitude or angle of observation is kind of makes the thing. It's like when you're outside of it, it's this great mystery, and in the process of making it real, it's not that the mystery disappears, but it very much shifts in terms of what parts of reality you can rely on and what parts remain kind of mystified, which in a way is part of what that structure, that hierarchical structure does, is it forces you to, like, be on the outside, and then you get in, and then the in creates another outside, and there's this very interesting balance. And I'm curious, because you were talking about hierarchy before and some of the political problems with it. Obviously, traditional magical orders are, at least on paper, in many ways, extremely hierarchical. You go up these grades, the grand poobahs up above have certain, you know, powers and controls that you don't have. They know things they're not going to tell you. You know, it's very much structured in this almost classic pyramid way, which is so different than the shamanic rural archetype that we were talking about, and that you have said, you know, that in a way you're more sympathetic to. What do you think is the value of that kind of hierarchical structure? Do you think it's inherently kind of dangerous? I mean, some magical practitioners just sort of reject it out of hand, but other people find a great deal of value to it, even in our era of calling into question hierarchies and those kinds of structures. So you think there's still some value there? How do you see that?
I see it as a natural outcome involving the time-intensive process of how an initial epiphany or vision is realized. It's a little bit like the way the world's religions have formed. You know, it usually starts with one person like Buddha or Jesus of Nazareth, you know, or Muhammad. And from that one individual who had a vision and a way of life and really an embodiment of a particular spiritual life, after that, there was people who were trying to preserve that. And they would preserve it by developing certain beliefs and certain cosmologies to try to protect and preserve. And that became its own hierarchical indoctrination of spiritual dogma that became, you know, the religion itself. And so I think it's just part of human nature to go that route. Even the rural magic, as I won't give this away because it's a bit of a funny part in the movie, but even the rural Bruja was participating, you know, with a certain hierarchy in her. She had an apprentice, too. And she had a certain condition that he had to participate in this condition in order to gain teaching from her. And I think it's across the board. It just looks different in rural magic.
Well, but that's the difference between rural magic and the religions made after, like, Jesus or Buddha, is that the apprentice is eventually going to learn all the things that the Bruja knows and will get the teaching so he can do it himself. But the weird thing that happens with hierarchies, you know, in the religions and in other places other than the rural is that they're just protecting that thing that Jesus did, but no one thinks that they can be Jesus, right? There's a separation where it goes to another level where no matter how much you apprentice with Jesus, you'll never be Jesus. But,
well, right. I personally don't, you know, condone it, of course, but I think that there's the side of religions that's called social control and the organization of social activities. That's not going to go away. I think hierarchy serves people who have a greater need for structure, for example, and for assigning a certain amount of their autonomy to a larger authority, whether it's an organization or a person, to build some kind of a security base in their life. And I can't judge that. I mean, they're just people. People have different needs. And so this is why I think that, you know, the whole notion of hierarchy, even though it's going to be outdated in some areas, people outgrow it. There will always be certain sections in groups of people that cling and cleave to it because it's useful to them.
You know, this for me, this raises an interesting question. It just popped in my head. I mean, one of the things that your film is about transmission, how the baton is passed. So. There's a magical order, it's working great, everybody's psyched, the magus is wonderful, and the magus dies. What happens? How does the baton pass? It's a political problem, in our era, it's a legal, can be a legal problem, but it's also a problem of judging spirituality. Like, is someone else ready for this? Are they ready to go to the next level? Who gets to say? How do you know whether the guy's description of the HGA is really the HGA? What does it mean to say what really the HGA is? It's very difficult, especially in these more alternative, you know, practices, but even in something like Zen, where you're like, you know, at some point there's a transmission, and, you know, the master, you know, authenticates the insight, the satori or the kensho of the person who's coming after them, but you're like, well, how do they know? You know, how does that work? And then, and the same thing with the apprentice with the rural Bruja. So there's this sense about when you have we've created a magical structure that works, that has people and ideas and concepts. They can be more or less organized, but regardless, at some point there's this question of does it carry forward. And so the question I'm going to throw to you, slightly different angle, is you have developed an extremely singular approach to, let's call them, the mysteries. In your text, They're very practical, pragmatic, as well as mind-blowing. There's a lot about practices, you know, many, many different kinds of practices. You've been involved in a unique approach to ritual, to artistic experimentation, how those things interact, working with individuals, working outside of a lot of conventional maps of what theater is, what performance is, what magic is, et cetera, et cetera. So you have a very interesting, very unique approach to the mysteries. Do you think about how that passes on?
Yeah. So, regardless of all the various methods I develop and apply, the techniques, the methods, the approaches, and it's true, I work with a number of them. I relate to all methodologies and techniques as secondary to what they are capable of triggering, which is if they're effective, they're going to be triggering the experience of an energy. And transmission, when you use that word, what comes to mind is initiatic experience. And so to me, in my personal life, but also in context to this story, this movie. This movie is about many things, but one of the things it's also about is initiation on a number of different levels. There's a number of different initiations that are occurring in this movie, and each one of them involves a specific transmission. And initiation, to me, doesn't always require ritual or any kind of technique, although sometimes it can. Initiation and transmission refers to basically any experience that erupts, that really comes forth, you know, unplanned, really, out of the blue almost, and brings us to a place that we have no previous reference of, we have no previous maps or models of, we don't know what the hell is happening, and we enter into this wide open, receptive place to life itself or to whatever it is that's happening in the moment. So there's a vulnerability and an unmasking and an openness to the cosmos and a kind of a slam dunking into direct experience itself, whatever that might be. And that, to me, that experience is the guiding principle of my life personally. I don't, you know, pretend or, you know, think or believe that's what guides other people, but that's what guides me. And so that's what guided, you know, the direction of this particular story, because I made the story, I made the film, so I, you know, I have a bias, I have a kind of direct experience bias. And so I was looking for the places where each of the characters could encounter an event that they didn't have any previous maps or models to figure out. I mean, even the Magus himself, you know, who's done all this study in this story. He's all this study and practice. He's like an expert in sex magic and on and on. When the demon shows up, he's trying all kinds of ways to make the demon go away, and he discovers at that point, at some point, that all his methods, all his techniques, everything he knows have been rendered futile in the face of the moment. And in that moment, he's finally feeling helpless and open enough to ask for help. And to me, that moment is a very human and very important moment, this place where you reach the place where by your own efforts alone, you are not going to move forward, where there is this place where either you ask for help or you don't.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a way, that's the moment of rural magic. That's the moment of recognizing that attunement to a larger environment, or really that's your only option.
I don't think so. I think it's a human moment, which I think is bigger than rural or urban. I think it's a genuinely human moment to reach that moment of asking for help.
I feel like it's a moment when we realize that we don't exist in a vacuum, and that's what those moments that allow people to actually legitimately break out of their egos to see, like, oh, wait, I can't just do this alone, or I am not just in this alone.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. That's exactly right. But because he is locked into the magical world, he's open to help from another magical world. you know, which is why, you know, he seeks out the help of the desert Bruja, even the two, although the two of them are like cats and dogs, you know, they don't get along.
That's true. That's a, there's a lot of that good a grit in the movie as well. It's definitely not an idealized portion. I love the way that the Bruja is a good witch sometimes. And it's like, yeah,
so
that's it. It's so
yeah.
that kind of and the way that they're both, their two worlds play with amorality in different ways. I mean, it's really wonderfully drawn. Well, here's another kind of question. Let's stay with initiation. We just have a couple minutes left, so this will be the last little response. But do you think that all of those secondary practices, et cetera, that it's possible to teach people how to increase the likelihood that they're going to stumble into a legitimate initiation? Or is it all? Is there something always wild and unpredictable about it?
Well, it's really both. I produced a video document based on a performance called Orphans of Delirium back in 2004, and we worked for 4 months with a group of 11 on the development of rituals and movements and forms that just might trigger initiatic experience. That was the experiment. And so we were able to develop directions that actually resulted in these kinds of experiences for people, and they have in many ways set that person on a course, each of the 11 in different ways, that whatever happened back then in 2004 will always be remembered as a pivotal turning point, as something where a time where something definitely went a different direction that they had not expected or they didn't have any previous maps or models for. It's possible to teach it as long as the people that I'm working with are aware of the intention and aware of the possibility of opening to experiences that you don't have any previous maps or models for. Some people, once they're open to that intention, they don't want any part of that because it's scary. And actually, I think it is scary, but some people handle that fear better than others, and other people just, you know, don't want anything to do with it. They'd rather, you know, find a ritual or a way of moving through the world where they can maintain more of a sense of knowing what's going on and more certitude about things. And that's fine too, you know. So,
right.
But so the answer is yes, it's both. There's wildness and there's an X factor and unpredictability. And yes, it's a worthy experiment to seek out and develop forms that might just trigger that.
Wonderful. Well, we're going to have to end it there. Antero, thanks so much for being on Expanding Mind with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
And folks can check out verticalpool.com for more information. And if you're in Berkeley, go see the show on the Equinox. From Maj and me to all you out there, keep your minds open. We'll be right back.